Back with Air Marshal C.R. Dunlop. It's the 10th of June, 1980.
Okay. Right. Now, before we pick up again on Mountain Dew, there are one or two things I want to finish off about Mountain Dew. I have something here I'm going to put on the tape for the amusement of Dr. Roy, Reg Roy. I'm in the process at the moment of preparing a speech which I'm going to give down in Ottawa next week, subject of which is the interplay between civil and military aviation. In doing my research for that, I started way back in the early days of aviation and picked it up about the time of the renowned Santos Dumont, the Brazilian who spent so much of his life in Paris, first of all as a balloonist and then as a operator of powered balloons or airships, the embryo airship. Famous, as you know, for having done the circuit around the Eiffel Tower in 1901, took to aviation power flight a few years later and made his first successful powered flight in a heavier-than aircraft in 1906. Now, on that occasion, that was in September of 1906. He made a few hops, a few feet above the ground and 75 to 100 feet in length. That was considered quite spectacular, even though the Wrights had far exceeded that in the United States. In France, not very much had happened up to that point. I'm not suggesting that he was the first one to get in the air in France, but this was his first venture. And by mid-October, he lengthened his line to all of 200 feet. And that still in Europe is considered quite something. The news of what the Wrights had done in the United States hadn't penetrated it very far in the European mind. It hadn't penetrated at all in the U.S. mind. Nobody in the States paid any attention to the Wrights, so they were not adequately reported, and that's one reason in Europe they weren't too conscious of how far the Wrights had gone. So this matter of flying 200 feet was a fair story, and it was written up in the Daily Mail in London. And it was written up purely as a special feat of flying with no regard whatsoever to possible future consequences. When Lord Northcliffe, when Lord Northcliffe read his editor's item concerning Santos Dumont's flight, he was quite upset about it. He had the editor in and told him that he completely missed the significance of this feat. And he said to his editor, "You have missed the significance of the event. Don't you realize England is no longer an island? No more safety behind the wooden walls of old England, with the channel our moat." The new edition of the next edition of the Daily Mail carried this editorial: "The time is probably near at hand when this primitive stage in flying will be followed by aircraft that will be commercially utilized. The air around London will be darkened by the flight of airplanes. Military frontiers will be virtually annihilated. Aircraft will have the ability to pass freely through the air, over the sea, and over naval fleets. The isolation of the United Kingdom may disappear. Thus, the Santos Dumont success has an international significance. They are not dreamers who hold that air power will be, or may be, even more important than sea power. Now, that was quite a pronouncement in 1906. Northcliffe was really so impressed by what had happened, and he was so incensed by the fact that in Britain nobody was taking this manner of flying very seriously. There were certain efforts being made in several quarters of England to get into flying, but nobody of any import was taking the matter seriously. In order to do something about this, he decided that he would offer a prize to stimulate development in the United Kingdom. And on November the 17th, 1906, which was very many weeks after the Dumont flight, he offered $50,000 prize for the first flight from London to Manchester. It was the first of many prizes which Lord Northcliffe was to offer to encourage the development of aircraft in the UK. Now, he was ridiculed for this offer, and he was charged with trying to gain cheap publicity by making such a wild offer, which would never, ever be taken up or won. Punch was, the magazine Punch was particularly critical and scathing and jocular about this Lord Northcliffe's offer. And one of the limericks, I don't know whether this, I don't imagine this appeared in Punch, but one of the current limericks of the day, and I thought this might amuse you, Reg, went as follows. There was a young man of Park Lane who constructed a new aeroplane. It rose like a prick, then fell like a brick. His tombstone was pretty and plain. The prize of $50,000 for a flight from London to Manchester was won within 4 years of the time of the offer. That is, by 1910. Then, of course, even before that date, Northcliffe had offered a substantial prize for the first flight across the English Channel. And that was won by Verio, as you may recall, in 1909. So he was giving money away at a fair rate for spectacular feats. The next major prize that I know of that he offered was the one in 1913 for the first flight across the Atlantic, first flight nonstop across the Atlantic. Now, if he were ridiculed in 1906 for his offering him a prize to fly all the way from London to Manchester, you can imagine the ridicule he got when he made this offer for a flight across the Atlantic. Well, it was many years before that prize was won. For the year after the war ended, in 1919, we saw Alcock and Brown make their historic flight from Newfoundland to Ireland. Well, that's just by the way. I thought it might be interesting to put that on the tape.
Right, indeed it is.
Well, let's get back to Mountain View. There were a few items we didn't have time to cover last week, and you recall that I went to Mountain View at the beginning of 1942, and it was just very shortly after the Japs had entered the war and did it in such spectacular fashion at Pearl Harbor. Mountain View is a long way from the West Coast, and you wouldn't expect Mountain View to get involved in any way in this. As you can imagine, the priority for tightening up the defenses on the West Coast shot up quite a bit after the experience at Pearl Harbor, because there was always a remote possibility that an aircraft carrier might come close enough to some West Coast city and launch a few aircraft to do a bombing raid. And that had the effect of the development of certain joint defenses between the U.S. and Canada out on the West Coast. The U.S. was really strapped, because the losses at Pearl Harbor were severe, very heavy indeed, the losses in naval ships and in aircraft carriers and in aircraft was heavy there, and of course the losses on the ground at, and on the airfield at Pearl Harbor was heavy. So for quite a time the U.S. forces were strapped, and Canada entered into an agreement to provide some assistance up there in the northwest. In satisfaction of that undertaking, there were two wings of aircraft sent up to Alaska. One known as Y Wing. I don't know why the wings weren't numbered. I've never discovered that. Y-Wing was sent to Annette Island in May of 1942, and it was really primarily for the defense of Prince Rupert. Annette Island is getting fairly low down on the Alaska Panhandle, so it's not too far removed from Prince Rupert. That was not so much to help the Americans as to help ourselves. But, of course, it did provide some protection up in the Alaskan area. An X-Wing went much further north, and it was based up in Anchorage, Alaska. And its function was to do reconnaissance and defensive sweeps out over the Aleutian Islands. And you may recall that the Japs did penetrate as far eastward along the Aleutian chain to Sitka. Kiska Island. And in the latter stages of the activities of X-Wing, they flew out as far as and did offensive sweeps against Kiska. It's funny, there is a Sitka, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is.
Kiska. And in the course of which, strange enough, I don't know why I should say strange enough, but there wasn't very much contact made with the Japs, but one of our chaps was able to shoot down Jap aircraft, so that was squad leader Boomer. He was the CO of 111th Squadron. He was had the distinction of having the only victory in the air against enemy aircraft in the home war establishment of Canada, the RCAF. The rest of the time, the home war fellows were devoting most of their attention trying to sink submarines. And there weren't any enemy aircraft close enough to really get into close contact. Well, now, how does this relate to Mountain View? In the excitement about the possibility of the Japanese getting a bit closer to our West Coast centers, some of the keen types at Mountain View, and there were a lot of very keen individuals there, decided that we would form a squadron from amongst our resources and operate what you almost might call a reserve squadron within the permanent force. And this was done by selecting crews for 18 aircraft. And we did training exercises on the Bolingbroke as a squadron, doing formation flying, doing formation bombing, and doing all things that you might, that one would have to do to work up a squadron if an emergency were called to serve. So these fellows volunteered their time and worked in the evenings after having done their day's work, flying these Bolingbrokes on squadron training exercises. We did this with, of course, the approval of our command headquarters in Toronto, the number one training command headquarters. And it was a fairly an extracurricular activity by a group of enthusiastic lads who felt that we at least would have one relatively well-trained and well-equipped squadron to go to the aid of the West Coast if they needed something. That lasted, of course, for quite some time, until the Japanese finally withdrew from Kiska on that end of the operation. Wing Commander Lister, my chief instructor, was the big push behind that, and he was the chief instructor and the CO of the Armament School, and a keen type, so that's the way that came about. Well, now, there were a few other things that I told you I was going to speak about. One of them was inspections. We didn't get that. We didn't get into that, did we?
No, we didn't.
The other was wings parades and so on. I think I did mention the fact that we had, because we were graduating air gunners and bomb aimers at such a rapid rate there, that we had a wings parade with great frequency. I think we were graduating close to 100 per month, so that there was a wings parade every month. And the wings parade was a was an important ceremonial occasion, an important graduation, and the public was, of course, invited, mainly the friends and relatives of those graduating were in attendance, that is, those who happened to be living close enough to make it feasible, and we had people come from all over Ontario and from Quebec and so on, but not too often from beyond that distance, but and the local public would come out to see the parade and cheer these boys on, so it was quite a function. And I might say it took every member of the graduating class marched forward and received his wings either from the CEO of the station, in this case myself, or from some other dignitary who in some way might have been, or not necessarily dignitary, some other serving personnel, for example, who might be connected, related to a graduate. We might invite them to actually present the wings and pin them on. It was a matter of pinning the wings on the uniform, and the lad would march forward, come to attention, have his wings pinned on, and a few words of congratulations, and then he would retire back to his comrades on the parade. There would always be a little function afterwards and to celebrate the occasion. This would be in one of the, generally in the Airman's Mess, because that was the biggest one we mess that could accommodate them, and tea would be served for the guests with those dudes, and so on. We had regular CO's parade, of course, once a week. And from time to time, there were special parades brought about by visiting dignitaries, generally speaking, one's AOC or the chief of the air staff or maybe the air member for personnel coming down to see how well-trained and disciplined the troops were, and so on. I'd only been in Mountain View for 6 days when I got a message from Number 1 Training Command Headquarters in Toronto to say that AOC would be inspecting my unit. And it was just a reminder to me that he was coming in 2 days' time. My predecessor evidently had the warning. He neglected to tell me about it. So there wasn't very much time for preparation for the AOC inspection. I got on the phone to one of the senior staff officers in Toronto and to remind him that, and ask him to remind AOC that I had just within the week arrived at Mountain View, and perhaps under those circumstances he'd rather come to inspect a little bit later on. I was informed without any delay or hesitation that the AOC worked very much the calendar. And on his calendar, my station, Mountain View, was due for inspection. And it didn't matter to the AOC whether I'd been there for 15 minutes or 15 years. The inspection would take place. It did. And the inspecting officer was Air Vice Marshal G.E. Brooks, George Eric Brooks, famous in the Air Force for his constant and incessant conversation. He never stopped talking. Hence the name the Babbling Brook. A name, as a matter of fact, a nickname that, strangely enough, he never was aware of during his service career. I suppose some nicknames like that are always behind one's back. And it wasn't until the night of his retirement, and I was at that retirement dinner, that the chairman of the evening, Roy Stemmon, and was the chair that night of this farewell dinner, and there were several other people retiring the same night, and Roy had a few words to say about each of these retiring officers, in the course of which he mentioned, in each case, the well-known nickname of the person retiring. He came to Brookie, and he mentioned this. Brookie looked terribly surprised and a little bit dumbfounded that anybody would make such a suggestion. Well, Brookie arrived, and he was a very thorough examining, inspecting officer. One of the things that he was good at was digging into things. And of course, in 6 days on a unit the size of the Mountain View, I hadn't really had an opportunity to get in and see all the building. Well, I knew what every building was, but you didn't get to know every room in every building. And I can recall we got to the supply depot. He said, yes, we'll, most important place in the station to inspect is the supply depot, said the AOC. And so in we went. And he said, now let me see, You've got three walk-in refrigerators in this supply depot. He'd been in these units all over the countryside. He knew the inside of it. I said, "Well, we'll just go through these." So we went through the one that had all the meat hanging in it, and he had an awful lot to say about the proper way. He was educating me a little bit. The proper way to inspect these places and what you should look for, and he would raise hell if something wasn't right. And I had my messing and catering officer at my side, and some of these remarks were thrown his direction. Then when we finished that one and gone through another walk-in refrigerator, he said, "Now, where's your cheese refrigerator?" And I said, "Sir, I haven't the slightest idea. I've been in this building before only once, but I'll have to rely on my catering officer to..." "Oh," he said, "I know where it is. It's around the corner. You go through that door and go around." So we went around, and we went, walked into the refrigerator that had the cheese. And it had the most colossal amount of cheese I've ever seen. In 100-pound heads, great big round heads.
Yeah.
All black diamond. Black diamond cheese.
Oh, boy.
Cheese was in a bit short supply in those days. And to see about 40 or 50 heads of black diamond cheese was really surprising. And the AOC was quick to show his surprise and his feelings. And he said to me, "Now, why have you got all that cheese?" And I had to confess my ignorance. And then he turned to catering officer. And he said, I put the same question to him. And the catering officer fumbled and stumbled around and couldn't think of a very good answer. And then the AOC said, "I suppose it's because you're a connoisseur of cheese and you like to let it age the right amount before you feed it to the troops." And the chap bit on this and said, "Yes, sir, that's exactly it." Then, of course, the next obvious question was, "Well, you show me now how you have designated or marked these containers so that you know which one came in yesterday and which one came in 2 months ago." And, of course, he caught the fellow flat-footed. Then, of course, with true Brooks style, he said, "Now, your entitlement is 1 ounce per man per day, and you've got 2,000 men in your unit. That's 2,000 ounces a day." He translated that into pounds, and he translated that into days. And he said, "Well, I reckon you've got 2 or 3 months' supply of cheese here. Just get in touch with the supply agencies and say no more cheese from on you for 2 months." And he was like that all over the station. He must have spent most of his time out on the road inspecting units, because there were, by this time there were so many, and and that's an exaggeration, of course, but there were an awful lot of units in Ontario, and in his command really was pretty well confined to Ontario. And he knew what to look for, and he knew all the tricks. You couldn't put anything over on him. But he was pretty good, and he showed his appreciation if the troops were well turned out on parade. He had the grace to show his satisfaction.
Did you ever find out why you had this large quantity of cheese on hand?
I think it was just the matter that we were drawing our cheese from the depots, and they were just taking our population of the station and the 1 ounce per man per day, and they were issuing that automatically. And there are lots of people in Canada who are not great cheese eaters, so we just were accumulating. And the catering officer hadn't been paying much attention to the extent of the accumulation. He was just letting it build up. So there was a little bit of carelessness, really.
Playing the old supply officer game where you build up on one thing and you don't use much of it, and you trade
it off
for something you really want. You know?
Well, yes, yeah, that could be, yeah. Well, AO's inspection went off pretty well on the whole. The next big inspection was when the chief of the air staff came to inspect. Air Vice Marshal Croyle, he was. In those days, we hadn't elevated the post of CAS to air marshal level. And Croyle his inspection was quite different character. Of course, being the chief of the air staff, he wasn't interested in all the details and buildings and hither and yon that the AOC was. he had to have a, take a broader look at things and confine himself more to parade and inspecting the troops on parade and perhaps just taking a delve into one of the hangars, perhaps in one or two of the quarters, just to show an interest in, just to see how things, what the level of cunningness and tightness and one thing or another was like in the unit. So, the big deal was the parade and the ceremonial parade and the inspection. It went off very well. And the chaps did cooperate and everybody was pressed to the lines and the shoes were shining. And I was really very proud of the turnout. But I was disappointed in the inspecting officer in that he didn't seem to see the people on the parade. And I'll tell you why. He had one thing that he was looking for and concentrating on, and that was on the jackets of the airmen. You remember there was a little flashing on the shoulder that had an eagle.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The head of the eagle was there. It was prescribed that the head of the eagle was pointed in, had to be pointed in the proper direction. And that meant, and of course, that meant there had to be a right-hand badge and a left-hand badge. And I can't remember now just what it was, but I presume the eagle had to be flying forward. You didn't want the thing flying backwards.
Yeah.
His whole time on parade. If you're looking for something like that, you haven't got an opportunity as you march down a couple of thousand people to look them up and down from head to toe and get a general impression of the turnout. You're looking almost entirely at shoulders. We went along flight after flight, and I could see that he wasn't seeing anything but these shoulders.
How long did it take you to twig what he was looking at?
Well, it didn't take very long. Yeah. It came up very quickly, and he had his aide out in front. And I soon noticed that his aide was flicking his finger every so often. And when he flicked the finger, that meant the flash was not properly oriented. So then he'd stop, and the lad had to be told that he was to take his jacket in and get the thing properly down. This went on for the longest time I've been around there. And there were a lot that had been put on wrong. It was the tailor's fault, really. It wasn't the airman's fault. It was the tailor's fault. But this was an item of great importance in the mind of Coyle. It's a pretty petty little thing, you know, for a chief to be worried about. It was the sort of thing that he could have said to to his commanding officers. Now, I've noticed that there has been some carelessness in putting on these things when the uniforms are tailored. Next time you're on parade, check it out, or have your warrant officer, your edge or something, check these out. Make sure you get people all uniform. Because a uniform is supposed to be uniform. You don't want birds flying backwards. That's all really that the CAS should have done, but it illustrated the character of the man, really, that he would go ahead and do that on his own. I was annoyed, really, because he didn't really see the chaps on parade, and they were well turned out. He was upset because there were so many of these damn things the wrong way around. And it put him in sort of a bad humor. And the only thing, there was one other thing that his aide was watching for, and that was for worn soles on shoes. Anybody had you can generally tell if you're a little trained in this, whether a shoe looks as though it's been worn a bit too long before being resoled. Every so often he'd point in some way at a shoe, and this fellow would be forced to lift his heel like a horse being shot. And so on. So that was...
Did he ever inspect you again?
No, no. Of course, he didn't get a, CS inspection very often.
Yeah.
Indeed, the CS would never inspect all the units. He never could, but he just at random would inspect a few units. Mine happened to be one of the ones. And I was rather fond of Coyle, but I certainly... wasn't very happy about that performance, and he was a fine man, but he was a little bit bogged down by detail, as you can tell from that example. He let the rather inconsequential matters interfere with the accomplishment of the more major ones. Now. Let's leave inspections. Well, during my time at Mountain View, we introduced females into service. In the initial stages, they were called the Canadian Women's Auxiliary Air Force, CWAAF. But before very long, they became a component of the RCF, and they didn't serve as an auxiliary force. They served as actually as part of the RCF, and became known as the RCF WD's Women's Division. So in early summer, I guess it was, of 1942, we were informed that we were to be honored with the arrival of the first detachment of women. I think there were 70 or 80 or 100 in that first detachment. Under the guidance of Section Officer Ball, very sound and very mature person, I think they picked their leaders extremely well in the Women's Division, and every case that I had any experience with, these Queen Bees, as they were called, were top-notch girls and competent, good leaders, and so on, who really had the interest of their personnel at heart and looked after them extremely well. But it was quite an experience to have a group of women arrive at a unit that had been exclusively a male center. We did, of course, have a few nursing sisters, not many. I have an idea. We had only two or three at Mountain View. I can remember two by name, but I have an idea there was a third. And they were the only ones you would ever see in the messes. Then all of a sudden, along comes a group. And, of course, all of our life in this service, from the time I joined back in 1928, there were never any women. Mm-hmm. It was sort of like a men's club, and the ladies were invited in only on special occasions to dances and things like that, and various matches. But after that, apart from that, no. But it, of course, worked out extremely well, and it was a very wise move to, from many points of view, to turn to the women to augment the manpower supply. And it was important. It was important not only to in that they release men for other duties. The more women we could feed into the organization, the more men that were available for overseas service and for their crew duties and so on. So it had a very beneficial effect. And then, of course, on top of that, there were certain trades that the women were more suited for in any event. Some of the clerical trades. The women were really better at than the men. And the cooking and the accounting and the supply stores and postal operations, so on. The women were well suited to, and of course, and eventually they went into many other fields. They were good in the instrument repair sections, and they were very good at parachute repair and parachute rigging area. They became quite useful as airframe and engine mechanics, mm-hmm. but that took a bit of time. Initially, when we got them, they weren't trained in those fields, but they got to the point where they did a fair amount of the more routine airframe and engine work. So by and large, they were a great asset. I don't know how our numbers in the Air Force compared with the quacks in the Army, but I do believe that we get up to around 11,000 or 12,000 at the peak period, and that was a fairly good percentage. We had overall, I guess, about 200,000 in the Air Force at that time. So about what would that work out? About 5% or something like that. A little bit more than 5% were women.
It was a higher proportion than the Army.
Yeah.
The Army only had about 14,000.
Oh, I see.
So there was
a good deal larger. Yeah, a good deal larger. Yeah. Well, they were an enthusiastic lot, and they had a very good effect on morale. They were smart, they turned out, and that had a good effect on the general smartness of the unit. It was a rather lousy design of uniform that they started off with. We copied the RAF pattern, and we didn't stick with that for very long. The women, the Canadian girls, wouldn't put up with that, and
it was the hat mostly, as I remember, wasn't it?
That was the hat was terrible.
Yeah.
And there was a new hat designed, and it was as smart as could be, so they wore that well, and the new uniform was properly tailored to the female form.
Mm-hmm.
The others weren't properly shaped and tailored, so they became the smartest looking group in a unit, and it caused the airmen to smarten up too, and before very long they got into the precision drill activities, and they were, of course, the women are awfully good at that. And the precision drill squad of the RCAF was really something to see. And they were, every unit was anxious to get somebody to a point where they could get them on the drill team. So by and large, it was a great success.
Tell me, if I ask you a question, was there any problem at this time with the disparity in wages paid, in pay, between men and women for the same job?
Yes, I think there was. One didn't hear of it too often. Didn't hear it in my case because they were so new that they weren't going to vent their feelings on that. Mm-hmm. But they were getting a WD standard, Women's Division standard trade. That was the lowest trade. That was the sort of the labor trade. I think they were getting 90 cents a day. And that was damn low. It was low by any standards, and it was low by comparison with the common laborer, the man who was doing that same type of job.
In the Air Force, the ordinary... Who was he getting, what, $1.20 or $1.00?
Something of that order, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not absolutely certain, but I think it was either $1.10 or $1.20. But to get less than a dollar was sort of almost an insult to these girls. And in due course, they pushed the pay for the standard up to $1.05 from 90. And to get more than a dollar, I think they felt was quite an accomplishment. And it did bring them much closer to the level. I think it brought them up to about 80% of the level of the airmen. So you must have been right. It must have been up around $1.20, $1.25. So, yes, there was, but nobody seemed to be too upset about salaries. The troops themselves weren't getting very much money, and the girls were getting food and clothing, and their entertainment was provided on the unit. There were lots of dances and one thing and another, and lots of men to,
more men they can cope
to look
with,
after
sure,
them.
Yeah.
So, they seemed to be relatively happy in spite of their pay. But, yes, surely women don't like to be treated in an inferior category, and many of them are more capable than men on some of those tests anyway.
Well, it would certainly be more of a problem today than it would have been.
Yeah,
sure.
That's right, yeah.
Didn't many WDs go overseas?
Yes. They did. Now, the first overseas assignment, their detachment, I guess, went to Newfoundland. Newfoundland was considered an overseas post. And, Newfoundland wasn't part of Canada in those days.
Yeah.
And you had to go out to sea in order to get there. And I remember when, before I left Mountain View, we were asked to nominate some of our better types, more responsible types, to go to assignment to. I guess we were told Newfoundland, but the personnel themselves were not aware just where they were going. And that was the start of the, and I think you'd have to put overseas in quotes for Newfoundland, but that was the start of the overseas assignment. I remember that, on that particular instance, those girls who were, they were posted in Halifax, and they were told they were on overseas assignment. I think they all assumed they were going to the UK, and they boarded ship, and they went off in convoy, and they remained in convoy for quite a time. I don't know why they were in convoy so quite so long, but they broke off at the nominated point and then headed for St. John's. And all in all, they were at sea for nearly 3 days. So you can imagine that they thought they were headed overseas.
Yeah. Finding themselves practically home again.
Yeah. But that was a tremendous boost to the morale of the troops in Newfoundland. Newfoundland was, by that time, Gander, and most of those people went to Gander. It was a big unit. There would be 4,000 or 5,000 troops there. Practically all Air Force, but there was some Army because there were some ground defenses that at Gander provided by the Canadian Army. And you can imagine what a welcome sight. I believe there were a couple hundred in this first detachment that went in there. And they were, everyone was a was a Betty Grable in the eyes of the of the boys there.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And that worked out very well. And then, practically simultaneously, they started sending personnel over to the UK, to London, and to Sixth Group. And the build-up was, I can't tell you how many went over there. But there were a fair number that did go to the UK, and they gradually took over from the RAF, the Women's Royal Air Force personnel. Up to that time, and we did have women on the units over there, but they were all British. But it was a gradual takeover by the WDs.
Your officer ranks in the WDs were quite different, weren't they?
Yes, they were. There was, they went assistant section officer and then section officer. Those are the lieutenancies,
yeah.
First and second. There was a flight officer, was the equivalent of flight lieutenant there, and the equivalent of captain. And then there came squadron officer. Not squadron leader. And they were They were sort of, in some ways, related to the male ranks. And then came wing officers.